Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
A baseball game that descends into a riot.
Fans were just totally out of control. The players were just fearing for their lives.
The tumultuous origins of a beloved holiday.
The reaction to this special day was laughing and joking.
And an historic battle for workers' rights.
Whatever they could do to break the picket lines, they did.
Inside the walls of great institutions lie extraordinary relics, tales of intrigue and wonder, and secrets waiting to be revealed. These are the mysteries at the museum. Dudley, England, is located in a curiously named region called the Black Country, a tribute to its once abundant coal reserves, which transformed the area into a mining mecca during the mid-1800s. Today, one institution celebrates this history, the Black Country Living Museum. Stretching across 26 acres, its historic buildings replicate a traditional 19th century factory town. But amidst the homes and workshops, is an unusual artifact that seems to serve no practical purpose.
It's 10 inches by 10 inches. It's made of wood and paper and metal. And if you look through the viewfinder, you will see a series of cartoons moving quickly to make it look like a woman is undressing.
According to journalist Louise Holland, this machine is linked to a shocking story that titillated the country and forever tarnished the reputation of a beautiful socialite.
It offers a tiny glimpse into one of the biggest society scandals of 19th century Britain.
What is this device? And what salacious tale does it tell? Inverary, Scotland, 1880. 22-year-old Gertrude Elizabeth Blood is a rising star in Britain's poshest circles.
Gertrude is beautiful, she's magnetic, she's funny, and she's very, very clever.
Like most society women of the day, Gertrude hopes her looks and charm will help her secure a suitable husband and a happy marriage. That fall, Gertrude thinks she's met the man of her dreams, a wealthy and handsome bachelor named Lord Colin Campbell.
He was 27 years old and the youngest son of the 8th Duke of Argyll, so very well-to-do.
The two fall in love at first sight. And after a whirlwind 3-day courtship, Lord Colin asks for Gertrude's hand in marriage. Gertrude eagerly accepts.
Gertrude would have been delighted with this engagement. She wanted a rich husband, and Lord Colin Campbell was definitely that.
And in July 1881, she and Lord Colin wed. The couple moves to Lord Colin's well-appointed home in London, where a staff of butlers and maids see to their every need. But Gertrude's newlywed bliss is cut short when she receives horrifying medical news.
Gertrude is diagnosed with syphilis.
Gertrude knows she could only have contracted the venereal disease from her husband. it seems that he's been having illicit relationships with other women.
It was a devastating realization for Gertrude because he'd put her health at risk for the sake of his own physical needs.
Gertrude never recovers from the betrayal. So, in 1886, she decides to sue Lord Cullen for divorce.
The idea of getting a divorce in Britain in 1886 was very controversial.
Due to the restrictive laws of the day, the English court system typically grants divorces only in the most extreme situations. But Gertrude believes the evidence of her husband's guilt is so strong, she'll easily win the case. But she is gravely mistaken. Fearing Gertrude's accusations will damage his family name, Lord Cullen turns around and sues Gertrude for divorce. And he makes a shocking allegation of his own.
He cited adultery as the grounds for his own divorce petition.
Lord Cullen's salacious charges leave little to the imagination.
He gave the names of her alleged lovers, he gave dates, and he gave the rooms inside the house where these affairs were supposed to have been conducted.
The titillating details quickly hit the tabloids. And by the time the trial begins in November, all of England is gossiping about Lady Campbell.
So this was humiliating for both of them.
In court, Gertrude denies her husband's tawdry claims, but her testimony is overshadowed by the defense's star witness, the couple's former butler.
The butler of the London home that she used to share with her husband, Colin, said that he had seen Gertrude in compromising positions with other men in the parlor because he was watching her through the keyhole.
Though the butler's account is riveting, the jury questions its veracity. How could so much be viewed through a tiny hole? So the judge takes the surprising step of ordering the jurors to look for themselves.
So the entire jury is then marched to Gertrude's London home so that each and every member can take a peek through the keyhole to see if the butler is telling the truth.
What will the jury see? One by one, the jurors peer through the keyhole, and they soon reach a unanimous conclusion.
They can see enough through that keyhole to lend credence to the butler's testimony.
But while the tawdry details fascinate the jury, it seems that not even a case this salacious can overcome England's restrictive attitudes toward divorce. And both Lord and Lady Campbell's petitions are denied. Following the embarrassing trial, Lord and Lady Campbell retreat separately to private life. Lord Cullen succumbs to syphilis 6 years later, at the age of 42. Yet even after his passing, Lady Campbell struggles to escape the scandal's lengthy shadow. In fact, the humiliating episode soon takes on a life of its own. Gertrude's fall from grace triggers an entertainment phenomenon in the form of machines called mutoscopes, just like the one at the Black Country Living Museum.
When the crank is turned, the pictures flip by really quickly. They look like an animation of a woman removing her petticoat. And it was the view that you would get if you were a butler looking through a keyhole that you shouldn't have been looking through. Totally inspired by the divorce case.
These mutoscopes pop up in bookstores and pubs all across England. Eventually, they come to be called what the butler saw machines, blatantly capitalizing on Gertrude's shame.
It was cheap, it was interesting to look at, and it took the world by storm. But it did so at the expense of dragging an innocent woman through the mud.
Today, this what the butler saw machine offers a tiny glimpse into one of the biggest brouhahas of 19th century England. Located at the foot of the Rockies, Boise, Idaho is considered one of the top mountain biking destinations in the country, with over 130 miles of trails. And it's this connection to the outdoors that's celebrated at the Morrison Knudsen Nature Center. Visitors can get a glimpse into the state's varied terrain and wildlife, with displays featuring live fish, birds' nests, and taxidermied predators. But there's one item in the collection that appears unrelated to the animal kingdom.
It's made of lumber. It's 30 inches long. 16 inches wide, and when you first look at it, it looks like it couldn't really have much of a purpose.
According to Center Representative Steve Liebenthal, this crate represents a kooky concept to control the natural world.
This was an unorthodox experiment that proved that sometimes it's good to think outside, or in this case, inside the box.
So what is this device? And how was it used to contain a pesky problem? 1948, McCall, Idaho. Situated at the edge of beautiful Payette Lake, this rustic resort town is booming, with new residents and visitors arriving every day. But there's one furry guest that's creating a huge problem. The beaver. Considered nature's engineers, beavers normally play a crucial ecological role. The dams they build ease flooding and erosion and help enhance wetlands. But in the town of McCall, they're far more destructive.
They would take down trees, they would interfere with orchards, and were really just a nuisance to the people who lived in this place.
The task of taking on these bothersome beavers falls to the Idaho Department of Fish and Game. But Conservation Officer Elmo Heater knows that killing the animals off isn't an option. Outside of McCall, the beaver population is in crisis. They are being hunted and trapped, and their declining numbers are throwing nature out of harmony. Heater and his team know that restoring that balance is key.
They wanted to transport beavers from the places they were causing problems to places where they could work to improve habitat.
Heater knows that one area of the state where the beaver population has fallen is the Chamberlain Basin, some 200 miles from McCall. But with no roads leading to this remote spot, getting beavers there won't be easy.
Well, this is a place nothing with wheels could even access. So you'd have to somehow put a beaver on a horse or on mules and take them up the trail.
Heater is determined to find a solution. And that's when it hits him.
Instead of thinking about the ground, he starts thinking about the sky.
The recent end of World War II has left a surplus of military equipment at local army bases. And among the extra supplies are parachutes.
He realizes if we can figure out a way to get beavers from an airplane to the ground using a parachute, our problems will be solved.
But dropping beavers from an airplane isn't as simple as strapping parachutes to their backs. The animals might not survive the trip. So Heater devises an innovative way to get them safely to the ground.
So Heater and his team assemble some lumber, some sisal rope, and some rubber straps.
Heater's team builds a box big enough to contain a beaver and straps it together. Tension from the parachute's ropes will keep the contraption closed on the way down. When it hits the ground, it will pop open and release the animal. The design sounds good in theory, but the only way to know if it will work will be to test it with a live beaver. The job falls to an older animal Heater affectionately nicknames Geronimo. Elmo Heater loads Geronimo into the box. Then, aboard a small airplane, they climb several hundred feet above McCall. Finally, Heater releases the contraption. Will Geronimo survive?
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
It's 1948 in McCall, Idaho. This small town finds itself overrun by beavers. But conservation officer Elmo Heater thinks he has a solution. He'll relocate the pesky critters into the backcountry by dropping the animals out of a plane using a parachute and a box that will open on impact. But will this outlandish idea actually work?
Heater watches as the parachute drifts towards the ground.
Heater is a little bit anxious, but I think he's also confident that when this box hits the ground, it will open up and Geronimo will make it to the ground safely.
And when the box touches down, it does just that. And Geronimo scampers out.
They check him out, make sure he's okay. He looks good and appears ready to go to his new home.
Having passed the test, the Idaho Fish and Game Department begins a series of relocations in the fall of 1948, dropping scores of beavers from the air. By the time the operation is over, a total of 75 animals are resettled in the Chamberlain Basin. And when Heater visits the area a year later, he's overjoyed by what he finds.
He sees that Geronimo and the other beavers have indeed gone to work and have created amazing habitat. The project was definitely a success.
Today, this replica of Elmo Heater's beaver drop box at the Morrison Knutson Nature Center in Boise recalls one man's wild idea and the ingenious stunt that allowed nature's engineers to soar. Lancaster, Pennsylvania is home to America's oldest settlement of the Amish, a religious group known for their simple way of life. And appropriate to a region that embraces the traditions of the past is a unique institution, Lancaster History. Its treasures include a 19th century Rockaway carriage, locally made furniture, and a plaster statue of one-time Lancaster resident, President James Buchanan. But tucked away in the institution's archives is a small keepsake marking an event celebrated far beyond Pennsylvania.
It is only about 3/4 of an inch in diameter. It has the picture of a white carnation. The stem trails into the words Mother's Day. It also has the writing in the upper right-hand corner, Anna Jarvis, founder, Philadelphia.
At first glance, this trinket appears to be a badge of pride. But as docent Thomas Englert can attest, it tells a much darker tale.
It symbolizes a woman's campaign to honor her mother, and yet her biggest accomplishment in the end destroyed her.
What role did this button play in the stormy past of a cherished holiday? 1905, Philadelphia. 41-year-old Anna Jarvis is heartbroken after the recent death of her beloved mother, Anne.
Anne was a kind and compassionate woman and would do anything for her children.
a noted public health advocate. She had worked tirelessly to reduce disease and infant mortality rates in Appalachia.
Anna, her daughter, looked up to her a great deal because of all the things that she had been doing to help other people.
Determined to honor her mother's legacy, Anna has an idea. What if there was a day dedicated to celebrating all mothers?
It would be a way children could tell their mothers how wonderful they were while they were still alive.
She envisions children of all ages visiting with their mothers and wearing white carnations, her mother's favorite bud, and a symbol of the purity of maternal love. Soon, a determined Anna begins an intense lobbying effort and proposes a new national holiday, Mother's Day.
Anna had a letter campaign to politicians all over the country.
But much to her surprise, her drive is quickly met with scorn.
The reaction to this special day by most men was laughing and joking. Why should there be a special day just for that?
Critics question the need for such a sentimental holiday. But Anna refuses to back down. She devotes herself to the cause full-time for 6 years. Finally, in 1914, her tireless work pays off. President Woodrow Wilson agrees to declare the second Sunday in May to be Mother's Day. Anna is thrilled. But little does she know, her success will also be her undoing.
Once Mother's Day became a national holiday, companies realized that there's another way of making a lot of money.
Anna is horrified as she sees her intimate day of celebration turn into a commercial juggernaut. She watches as businesses aggressively market everything from Mother's Day candies to expensive flower arrangements featuring the holiday's symbol, the white carnation.
The card companies also got involved, and she thought a ready-made greeting card was terrible. Why can't you sit down for 10 minutes and handwrite a letter to your mother?
Anna's anger only grows. One day, she visits a Philadelphia lunch counter and notices a Mother's Day salad on the menu.
Having a Mother's Day salad seemed to trivialize the whole idea of Mother's Day.
Anna orders the offending dish and, in a fit of rage, slams it to the floor. Mother's Day is now a holiday its founder cannot recognize. Anna Jarvis launches a campaign to preserve her original vision of Mother's Day. She threatens those looking to cash in on the holiday with boycotts and lawsuits.
She called these people charlatans, pirates and termites. The flower industry was a major enemy of hers.
To aid in her fight, she creates and distributes green and white buttons, including the one in the archives at Lancaster History. They bear her status as the official founder of Mother's Day. But it's not only for-profit businesses that feel Anna's wrath. In 1925, she fiercely takes aim at a charitable group, the American War Mothers, a patriotic organization created to support and honor mothers of World War I veterans.
It was surprising that Anna would demonstrate against this organization that her mother probably would have agreed with.
Anna is distressed by one of the group's fundraising methods. They're selling white carnations, the symbol of her holiday. So, a single-minded Anna brashly crashes the organization's annual convention in Philadelphia.
Anna was becoming unhinged. Police had to drag her out, kicking and screaming.
Anna Jarvis continues her fight to take back Mother's Day for decades. She even urges the federal government to abolish the holiday altogether. Finally, her obsessive campaign depletes her of her funds and her wits. In 1948, she dies penniless and alone in a Pennsylvania sanitarium.
Ironically, the time that she spent in the sanitarium was paid for by the florists, the people that she was fighting against.
Today, few people recall the rocky origins of one of America's favorite holidays, an annual celebration that is now a multi-billion dollar industry in and of itself. And at Lancaster History, this button is a small symbol of one woman's enduring love for her own mother and and her costly battle to preserve a holiday's true intent. Denver, Colorado is one of the biggest sports towns in America. Local fans can root for 7 professional clubs, including baseball, football, basketball, and hockey teams. So it's fitting that Denver is also home to an institution dedicated to the places people play ball, the National Ballpark Museum. Celebrated as one of the world's top baseball collections, its keepsakes include a light fixture from the original Ebbets Field in Brooklyn, a turnstile from the old Cincinnati Reds Stadium, and a uniform from the now-defunct Denver Bears. But one piece of memorabilia here provided a prime vantage point for more than just a baseball game.
The artifact that we have is dark green in color. It's made of wood, has cast iron arms, and on one side of the arm are the letters NY, and it represents a certain era of this country's history.
According to museum president Bruce Hellerstein, this artifact once played witness to an error that haunts the game to this day.
This item represents one of the best and worst times in the history of baseball.
To what century-old jinx did this artifact take a literal front row seat? September 23rd, 1908, New York City. More than 20,000 baseball fans line the stands of the Polo Grounds to watch a crucial game between two of the country's biggest rivals, the New York Giants and the Chicago Cubs. This key matchup determines who gets to advance to the World Series. And with the game tied 1-1 in the bottom of the ninth, it's a real nail-biter.
The Giants, being the home team, had one last shot to win this thing unless it went into extra innings.
With two outs and runners at first and third, all the Giants need is a base hit to get a runner home and clinch a spot in the championship. And then it happens.
The Giants got a base hit on a clean single to center.
The Giants' Fred Merkel sprints from first to second. The runner on third crosses home plate. It seems like the Giants have won.
The fans were just going crazy, and everybody there said, "We did it. Giants won the pennant."
But it turns out their celebration is premature.
Little did anybody know that Fred forgot to touch second base.
The Cubs quickly realize Merkel's mistake. Amidst the pandemonium, they scramble to get the ball to the second baseman, who then tags the base. Merkel is out, and the run does not count.
He's let down his teammates, all these fans. It just had to be the most heart-wrenching experience.
Giants fans storm the field in protest and refuse to leave. So the umpires have no choice but to declare the game a draw. But that leaves the question of which team will advance to the World Series up in the air. So baseball officials take the unusual step of holding a rematch.
It's a one-game playoff game, Cubs and Giants, played in New York at the Polo Grounds.
2 weeks later, on October 8th, thousands of spectators file into the stadium and settle into their seats, including this one, now on display at the National Ballpark Museum in Denver, Colorado. But Giants fans aren't just there to root for the home team. They make every effort to distract and disparage the visiting Cubs.
The fans were feeling that they were cheated out of a pennant, and they were going to do everything they could to vent their frustrations and really anger.
Despite the hostility, the Cubs persevere. And in a stunning upset, Chicago comes from behind to win 4-2. The victory secures the Cubs' spot in the World Series. But before they can relish their victory, all hell breaks loose.
The fans were just beside themselves.
Angry New York fans storm the field and chase down every Chicago player in sight. The visiting team runs to their locker room and barricades themselves inside.
The fans were just totally out of control. The Cubs players did anything but celebrate. They were just fearing for their lives.
It's the worst riot in baseball history. Yet it's only the beginning of Chicago's plight. Eventually, the police usher the Cubs players out a back entrance.
Through some sort of miracle, the Cubs players were able to eventually get out of New York City and escape out of this uncontrollable situation.
The Chicago Cubs go on to win the 1908 World Series against Detroit. And while memories of the violent episode fade into history, some say it spawned one of the most infamous curses in the game of baseball.
The Cubs haven't won a World Series since then.
Because the Giants lost their first matchup on a technicality, many feel the Cubs shouldn't have gone to the 1908 World Series in the first place, and that their 107-year losing streak is fate settling the score. A score that might have been different if only Giants player Fred Merkle had not missed second base.
There's no question that the Cubs probably were cursed because of Fred Merkle.
Today, this seat from the Polo Grounds, where the fateful 1908 games were played, is on display at the National Ballpark Museum in Denver. It serves as a reminder of the controversial call and the riotous event that engulfed America's favorite pastime. Bozeman, Montana is surrounded by some of the most spectacular scenery in the American West. But during the 19th century, what drew settlers to the region wasn't the view, but the discovery of gold. Today, the city is home to an institution dedicated to a different kind of treasure, the Museum of the Rockies. Its exhibits include the largest T-Rex skull ever discovered, the skeleton of a juvenile Triceratops, and a lifelike model of a Deinonychus attacking its prey. But amidst these prehistoric displays is a diminutive artifact that appears more alien than ancient.
The piece is about 8 inches long, and it's made of plaster and wire. And it is extraordinary.
As paleontologist Jack Horner knows firsthand, this unusual object sheds light on one of the biggest mysteries of the Jurassic Age.
This discovery helped change our whole notion of what dinosaurs were like as living animals.
How did an unlikely find in the hills of Montana revolutionize the field of paleontology? 1978, Montana. A young Jack Horner is a museum research assistant on a trip to the Badlands. He's on a quest to explore and examine the area's mountainous terrain for fossils.
As far back as I can remember as a kid, I have always been interested in dinosaurs.
During his trip, Horner wanders into a local curiosity shop.
They were selling fossils, and the place was just littered. I mean, there was just stuff everywhere.
As Horner browses the cluttered store, the owner asks him a favor. She needs help identifying some unusual items.
She said, "Oh, by the way, do you know what these little things are?"
And when Horner takes a close look, he's blown away.
In her hand were a few bones of a baby dinosaur. I had never seen anything like that before.
While countless adult dinosaur fossils have been unearthed, evidence of newly hatched baby dinosaurs is practically non-existent. Horner realizes the enormity of this chance discovery and presses for more information.
I asked if she would show me where it came from, and she agreed she would take us out there.
The shop owner leads Horner to a rocky mound near the town of Choteau, Montana. There, they begin to excavate the site.
We actually dug down into it and found a round structure.
As they dig deeper, the fossil hunter soon realizes he is looking at something that no other human has ever seen.
It contained more than 15 skeletons of baby dinosaurs, and they're all the same size.
The amazing find is a nesting ground, the first group of baby dinosaur bones to be found anywhere in the world.
It was extraordinary.
But as Horner closely examines the fossils, he realizes his discovery is even bigger than he had thought. In fact, he knows it could change everything about the very understanding of dinosaurs and evolution. So, what has Jack Horner found? Horner notices something on the fossils that makes it clear that the baby dinosaurs in the nest were cared for and fed.
Their teeth were all worn down. Was indicative that they had been chewing. Somebody had brought food to them.
The idea that dinosaurs nurtured their young defies decades of conventional wisdom about dinosaurs, a name that derives from the Greek words dinos and sauros, or terrible lizard. Since the 1800s, scientists have believed that dinosaurs behaved much like their modern-day reptilian counterparts, who abandon their eggs before they hatch.
The assumption was is that dinosaurs were big lizards, basically. They were cold-blooded, that they were green, and they were sluggish.
Yet if dinosaurs cared for their young in the nest, it would make them more like another type of animal that still roams the earth.
So it was very similar to what we see in modern birds.
Birds are social creatures that nurture their young for an extended period of time. And Horner knows that dinosaurs share other key traits with the avian species.
Dinosaurs got all the stuff that we think of as bird characteristics. They have hollow bones, they have wishbones, and they have three-toed feet. The similarities are immense. Almost everything about both of the animals are identical.
Horner's team unearths dozens of unique skeletons and more than 300 dinosaur eggs at the site, which comes to be known as Egg Mountain. This remarkable cast of a dinosaur hatchling emerging from its shell was assembled from fossils uncovered at the location and is now on display at the Museum of the Rockies.
This discovery helped change everything we knew about dinosaurs.
Jack Horner's chance discovery in a curiosity shop leads to a new evolutionary understanding of dinosaurs, not as monstrous beasts, but as the prehistoric ancestors of birds. Horner becomes one of the most respected paleontologists of the 20th century. In the 1990s, he even serves as a consultant for the blockbuster hit Jurassic Park. And today, this extraordinary cast endures as a testament to the unlikely find that reshaped the world's understanding of the link between bird and beast. Stretching inland from the scenic Pacific coastline is the esteemed University of California, Santa Barbara. This sun-soaked academic jewel is home to a half dozen Nobel Prize-winning faculty members. And at the heart of this idyllic campus sits the bustling Davidson Library. Here, students and visitors alike can view an array of historical artifacts, including early sound recordings, a Soviet soldier's Cold War-era scrapbook, and a tassel from the Ford's theater box where Abraham Lincoln was shot. But preserved in the library's special collections is an object of revolutionary significance.
The artifact is by 2 feet by 2 feet. It's red, made out of cotton. It has a black symbol of an eagle in the very center. And on the very top is the term huelga, which is Spanish for strike.
According to professor of history, Mario Garcia, this is far more than a simple flag.
This represents a contemporary David versus Goliath story, a monumental struggle.
What historic battle for justice was fought under this striking banner? Delano, California, 1965. For decades, migrant laborers working on the region's large produce farms have toiled away in deplorable conditions for low wages, often as little as 90 cents an hour.
Farm workers were the most exploited group in the United States.
But when employers slash their pay even further, the grape pickers of Delano decide they finally had enough. On September 8th, they go on strike. Joining their cause is the Mexican-American labor organizer and head of the National Farm Workers Association, Cesar Chavez.
His heart was always in the fields. His dream was to organize farm workers because he was a farm worker. He knew their history of exploitation.
Chavez stages demonstrations in front of the region's major grape farms. As they protest, workers brandish eagle-adorned posters, banners, and flags, similar to the one preserved at UC Santa Barbara's Davidson Library.
That eagle begins to represent the farm worker struggle.
But as the strike gains momentum, the growers' response turns brutal.
They rough up the workers on the picket line, and picketers were sprayed with pesticides. Whatever they could do to break the picket lines, they did.
Through it all, Chavez urges his fellow protesters to stand strong and not respond with violence.
Caesar was influenced by Gandhi and Dr. Martin Luther King, and nonviolence became central to Cesar Chavez's philosophy of organizing.
But by March 1966, the strike has achieved little. So Chavez takes another page from Dr. King's playbook.
He wanted to get mass media attention. He knew already that if it didn't happen in television, it didn't happen. So Caesar decides that he will organize a march to Sacramento.
On March 17th, Chavez and 69 fellow activists leave Delano. For the next 25 days, they walk over 300 miles to the state capital, picking up additional supporters along the way.
By the time they reached Sacramento, several thousand people were involved. It certainly was the biggest demonstration in historical terms with respect to farm workers.
Just as Chavez envisioned, the media is out in force to cover the event. But even with the publicity, most employers still refuse to meet the protesters' demands.
So Caesar felt that he had to raise the ante.
Chavez decides that the workers have to hit the powerful growers and produce companies where it hurts, the pocketbook. And to do that, he'll need the support of people far beyond California.
Caesar understood that he needed to appeal to many, many Americans. The decision was made to do a national boycott of table grapes.
Chavez knows that if shoppers stop buying grapes, it could force farm owners' hands. So will his bold plan work? Chavez sends volunteers around the country to rally churches, community groups, and other unions to back the boycott. Supporters stage demonstrations in front of grocery stores, urging shoppers not to purchase grapes. And before long, millions of consumers nationwide, from housewives to big city mayors, heed the call.
The boycott was a way that other Americans could support, in effect, what became a struggle for human rights.
The boycott works as Chavez intended, and soon, grape producers feel the effects on their bottom line.
They began to lose millions of dollars.
Finally, in the summer of 1970, California's biggest grape producers decide it's time to negotiate. Chavez and the union get the companies to agree to raise wages, provide benefits, and create more humane working conditions.
It was a major historical event. This is the first time that a farm workers' union is recognized in the United States.
Cesar Chavez is hailed as one of the most influential civil rights activists in American history. And his birthday, March 31st, is eventually celebrated as a California state holiday. And today, this flag at UC Santa Barbara's Davidson Library serves as a proud symbol of Cesar Chavez's lasting legacy as a transformative force for workers' rights. From the mother of Mother's Day to a salacious scandal, airdrop animals to a baseball riot.
I'm Don Wildman, and these are the mysteries at the museum.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.